and we'll go from there.
Good morning. Good morning, everybody. I'm asked to send a special greeting to Eva, who is out in Radio Land. There are people that get a podcast of this hour of the Forum class who feel like they're part of our group. Instead of making cassette tapes, the DP Bookstore makes CDs now. Rolf takes the master CD over to the bookstore, and I take a copy home. And in the afternoon, Sunday afternoon, I put both the iPod version, which gets the class comments on it, and then the regular mic'd version goes on my website. So if you have anybody that's nothing else to do and wants to listen to those, they're there. I strongly recommend Ray Steadman's notes back on the back table, especially in the material that we're studying right now. Ray is rich and deep and eloquent, so those are $3 a set back there. And I have a whole lot of commentaries on Isaiah. My sort of working favorite is Edward J. Young, who died some years ago, Westminster Seminary, 3 volumes. And what is good about him is that he takes the Hebrew letter apart verse by verse, which is very helpful. But it's interesting about all the differences in opinion in commentaries on Isaiah, particularly when we get to today's material on the virgin birth. But I'll leave that to you to sort out. Last week, we got up through chapter 6 of Isaiah. Remember, chapter 6 describes a great vision which the prophet Isaiah had in the year that King Uzziah died. King Uzziah had a long reign. He was built up the army, built up the fortifications. He was an agriculturally oriented man, so he dug wells and increased the pasture land. He moved down, established a city down at Eilat in the Red Sea. So he expanded the economy and the military, and he was considered a good king. Unfortunately, when he was well established on the throne, pride came into his heart, and he decided that he could go into the temple and offer an offering on his incense offering in the temple, which was something that only the priests were supposed to do. And when he did that, God struck him instantly leprous. And as a leper, he was then allowed not to mix with the public, so he had to go live in his own little private house. And his son, Jotham, was co-regent with him and had to do all the business and the back and forth. So he's, in effect, locked in prison for 10, maybe even 20 years of the last years of his long life, which is a sad ending. It says of him, as long as he trusted the Lord, God made him to prosper. The corollary to that is when he stopped trusting the Lord, God allowed him to not prosper. That's the idea. But anyway, in the year that he died, at the end of a good king, we begin to get into a darker period of time. And this is the year that Isaiah describes this great vision of the Lord high and lifted up, standing in the temple with seraphim, great and mighty angels around him. And the angels, the seraphim, all crying out, "Holy, holy, holy is the Lord of hosts. The whole earth is filled with his glory." The trishagion, the threefold repetition of the word kodesh, holy, which is three times for emphasis, the superlative degree. And Isaiah's response to that was, "Woe to me, I am an unclean man, I have unclean lips, I dwell in the midst of a people of unclean lips." So Isaiah felt very much shattered and undone by this vision of God. And one of these seraphim took a burning coal from the altar and touched his lips and burned the sin out of his speech, out of his thoughts, out of his mind. It's a very vivid image. And then after that, God asked for a volunteer to go speak to the people, and Isaiah said he would do that. So Isaiah volunteered to speak to the people, and then God said, "Well, you know what you're getting in for. You're not going to be very popular, and the message you're going to speak is essentially a message of judgment, because I'm taking truth away from the people now, because so they're not going to listen to you very much." Now, this great man on the throne, there's a little comment that's worth noting in John chapter 12, that just a quick look on chapter 6 before we move on. In John chapter 12, Jesus has just finished a long discussion with the Pharisees. And the Pharisees are skeptical and argumentative and doubtful. And John 12, John says, although Jesus had done so many times, so many signs before them, they did not believe in him. That the word of Isaiah the prophet might be fulfilled, which he spoke, and now he quotes from this very passage in Isaiah, Lord, who has believed our report, and to whom has the arm of the Lord been revealed? That's from Isaiah 53, actually. And then he quotes from Isaiah 6, therefore they could not believe because Isaiah had said, he has blinded their eyes and hardened their heart, lest they should see with their eyes and understand with their heart, lest they should turn, so that I should heal them. So John applies that to the situation in the time that Jesus was in Israel. And then he adds one interesting little clue. These things Isaiah said when he saw his glory and spoke of him. So he who is seated on the throne in the vision of Isaiah in chapter 6? Jesus. It's Jesus who is on the throne of Israel and the one that Isaiah saw and knew. So did people in the Old Testament know and see the same God that we do? Yes, they did. Okay? Now the first chapters, the first five chapters of Isaiah, which we already studied quickly, are a series of sermons, and it's hard to tell whether they come before or after this commissioning. The scholars are divided on, are these maybe messages that he spoke after this calling or before it? I think probably before. And then Isaiah had this calling and this commissioning to go to spend the rest of his life talking to Israel to warn them. We are about 150 years away from the fall of Jerusalem under Nebuchadnezzar. The northern tribes, the 10 northern tribes, we have no good kings among them all, 19 bad kings, are under siege from the Assyrians. And we're going to pick up the story at 7:1. Now, at 7:1, quite a bit of time has gone by. The whole reign of King Jotham is skipped over. Jotham was a co-regent under his father Uzziah, because Uzziah is a leper. He's got to go do the business of the court. He gets some years to reign on his own. He's not a bad guy. He's kind of sort of ordinary. And then he also seems to be a co-regent, partly under the reign of the bad guy that follows, Ahaz. Now, Ahaz is a very bad guy, very bad. And part of your homework is to read the account of his life, of Uzziah's life, in Kings and Chronicles. And I printed out for you an extra tiny print. Because you'll need to read both accounts and sort of fit them all together. But chapter 7, verse 1, it came to pass in the days of Ahaz, the son of Jotham, the son of Uzziah, king of Judah, that Rezin, king of Syria, and Pekah, the son of Remaliah, king of Israel, went up to Jerusalem to make war against it, but they could not prevail against it. All right, there's a... Now, here's where you go to Kings and Chronicles and find out why Syria and the 10 northern tribes are besieging Jerusalem. And it's God trying to get Ahaz's attention. It's God's doing. He's initiating this. And so he gets Syria and the 10 northern tribes to come down and assault Jerusalem. We get here just a quick little summary of something that actually is rather complicated. And that's why you need to read and find a little bit about this guy, Ahaz. He offered some of his children as burnt offerings to Molech. And he set up altars to Baal. He went to the sacred groves, the porn palaces, and got into all of the immorality that the Canaanites were into. The military campaign with Syria was actually long and involved, but recklessly he got himself involved with an actual war during which 120,000 of his troops, his father had built up this big army, but they all were killed. And he was taken to Damascus, prisoner, but later released. And when he was in Damascus, he saw this beautiful pagan altar up there, so he sent instructions to have his architect down in Jerusalem build a copy of it. He built the copy of this pagan altar and had it installed in the temple in Jerusalem. He pulled down the the utensils of the temple and the wash basin and rearranged everything and put this pagan altar in there for his own private use. Pretty serious desecration of the temple in Jerusalem. That's all in the fine spaces here. Syria came in at one point and took 200,000 people captive, men, women, and children captive from Jerusalem. That's a lot. And probably would have killed them except that a prophet named Obed came along and said in Samaria to the Ephraimites, to the 10 northern tribes, hey, these are your kinsmen, turn those prisoners loose. And so the prisoners were all sent down to Jericho and thus back to Jerusalem. It's a long stuff going in here, and it's hard to, it's a lot happening. So that's why I really urge you to read Kings and Chronicles a little bit. The other dumb thing that Ahaz did was that he went into the temple of the Lord in Jerusalem, took the gold and silver, and he sent it off to the Assyrians. And he said, I need your help against Syria and against the 10 northern tribes. Would you help me? What do you suppose the king of Syria said? Why, of course, I'll be glad to help you. And what's the king of Assyria? Is he going to be trustworthy? No. Egypt is also involved in here, too. So Ahaz has brought a whole bunch of bad stuff down on him. Okay, that's the background. That's all in verse 1. Okay? Verse 2. It was told to the house of David, saying, Syria's forces are deployed in Ephraim. That is, Syria and the 10 northern tribes are right on your border and they're threatening Jerusalem. His heart and the heart of his people were moved as the trees of the woods are moved with the wind. So this is a danger. It's a danger to the political and spiritual situation of Jerusalem, and Isaiah gets involved. And the Lord says to Isaiah, I got something that I want you to share with King Ahaz. I want you to take him out into outside the city, outside the wall, to a well-known upper pool on the highway to the Fuller's Field. Fullers are people that do laundry in the streams, washing, take in washing. You can still go there to this day, to this exact spot. 33 years later, as a matter of fact, the Assyrians are going to stand in that very same spot and threaten Jerusalem. So this is interesting. Ray points out that you don't want to miss all the layers of information that are tucked away in here. So the Lord said to Isaiah, go out to meet Ahaz and take with you your son, your little son named Shear-Jashub, whose name means a remnant shall return. Did you ever think of naming any one of your sons Shear-Jashub? A remnant shall return. Well, what's that? That's a long-term prophecy. That says hard times are coming for Israel, and this little kid is a sign to you people that in the long run there will be a remnant. We're going to prune this country down until we get only believers here. But anyway, Isaiah takes his son, and he goes out and meets this difficult, ornery, unbelieving Ahaz. And there's a message of compassion from Isaiah and a message of mercy and encouragement to Ahaz. And God says, say to Ahaz, take heed and be quiet. Do not fear or be faint-hearted for these two stubs of smoking fire brands. That would be Syria and the 10 northern tribes. Pekah, the second to the last king of the northern tribes. Don't worry. This is not going to materialize. These are just stumps of burned out wood. Don't be afraid of the fierce anger of Rezin of Syria and the son of Remaliah. Quite a few times here, Isaiah just leaves out the name Pekah. Pekah is such of no consequence, they don't even need his name. Pekah is the next to the last king of the 10 northern tribes. He's succeeded by Hoshea, and it's under Hoshea that the Assyrians finally capture and carry away the whole 10 northern tribes some 10 years later. Isaiah continues in verse 5, because Syria, Ephraim, and the son of Remaliah have taken evil counsel against you. This is what Syria and the northern tribes are plotting against you, saying, let us go up against Judah and trouble it, and let us make a gap in its wall for ourselves, and let's put our own king over them, the son of Tabeel. Tabeel would be a Syrian prince. Let's go in there and depose this Ahaz. Nobody likes him. And we'll put our own king on the throne in Israel, and he'll be a Syrian. And what would have happened if that had actually happened? We'd lose the bloodline that leads to Jesus. Does this sort of thing happen in the long history of the kings of Israel at other times? Yeah. Athaliah. You can think any number of times when the line of David is threatened in such a way that it looks like they're going to wipe out the heir to the throne. But you can't do that because Jesus has to come from that line. But it's a squeaky close call here, and Ahaz is a bad guy. But here's what the Lord says to comfort Ahaz. He says, verse 7, "Thus says the Lord God, it shall not stand, nor shall it come to pass. The head of Syria is Damascus, and the head of Damascus is Rezin." So I'm going to leave Syria and the northern tribes in place for a little while longer. They're not any threat to you right now. "But within 65 years, Ephraim will be broken, and it will not be a people. The head of Ephraim is Samaria. The head of Samaria is Remaliah's son. If you will not believe, surely you will not be established." That last is a play on words in Hebrew, which says, if you will not believe, you will find no relief. If you don't believe what God says, you're going to live with anguish and sleepless nights, and you're going to be tormented. But you don't have to worry, because God's not going to allow either Syria or the northern tribes to invade Jerusalem. So you're safe on that front. And if you wait around 65 years, there won't be any 10 northern tribes. Now, why 65 years? It's only 10 years until the Assyrians invade the northern tribes and carry them away. What's the 65 years, do you think? Tiglath-Pileser, the Assyrians, going to come in and destroy and invade the 10 northern tribes in 722 and capture Samaria. Then a few years later, Esarhaddon, who's a successor to another Assyrian, comes in and he does something more. He deports all the 10 northern tribes and replaces them with people who live off in the lands to the east. Replaces all the Jewish population in the 10 northern tribes with foreigners, except for a small number of Jews that stay there. Does anybody know what the long-term consequence of that move was? The origin of the Samaritans, who were so despised by ordinary Jews in Jerusalem. These foreign people came in with their foreign gods, intermarried with the Jews who were faithful to God. They brought their foreign gods with them. They realized that they were in the land that belonged to the God of Israel. So they had to hire priests in there so that they could get along with the God of the land. Long, long story. So, but that's all kind of cryptically woven into these few verses. Verse 10. "Moreover, the Lord spoke to Ahaz, saying, ask a sign for yourself from the Lord your God. Ask it, either in the depth or the height above." Now, that's a gracious move on God's behalf. Look, I know you're nervous, you're upset, you've been through a lot of trouble. God, let me give you a sign that would make you safe and feel secure so you can sleep at night and you don't have to worry about the invasion of Syria or Ephraim. And Ahaz says, thank you very much. I'd be delighted to have a sign from the Lord. Nope. Arrogant, stubborn, scared. I will not ask, nor will I test the Lord. That is not cool. God says, it does. It sounds awfully good. It sounds awfully religious and pious, doesn't it? Yeah. Oh, far be it from me to ask the Lord to go out of his way like that. Yeah, that's what that is. It's, I will not ask, nor will I test the Lord. And he said, and Isaiah said, hear now, O house of David. Isaiah's response, hear now, O house of David, is it a small thing for you to weary men, that you will worry my God also? That's God's response, is, Ahaz, you're an idiot. That's modern translation. Now, this takes, verse 14 takes a little unraveling, because now The prophecy continues, but it's no longer addressed to Ahaz. The pronouns change from singular to plural. The prophecy from this hand time on is addressed to the house of David, not to the man Ahaz, but to the people of Jerusalem. Therefore, the Lord himself will give you, Jerusalem, a sign. Behold, a virgin shall conceive and bear a son, and shall call his name Emmanuel. You've all heard that before. Volumes and volumes and volumes of arguing back and forth among the Bible scholars, because the word here for virgin is the word Alma, which can mean a virgin, but it also can mean a young woman, and so there's just no end of scholarly debate. But if you look a little bit carefully, I think you'll see this is one of those double fulfillments. It's got two fulfillments. There's going to be a son born in the immediate time period, but there's also going to be another son, a greater son, born in the long-term scale, and that later son is going to be named Emmanuel. And the interesting thing about this is, if you'll remember back when we were looking at the Ptolemaic period, when the second Ptolemy sent to Jerusalem, had all the rabbis come down and translate the Hebrew Bible into Greek. And now the immediate fulfillment's long over with, and in the Greek Bible, what do you suppose the word is for virgin or young woman? Well, it's parthenos. And that always means always a virgin. Can't be anything but a virgin. So if you look at the Greek Septuagint, it's virgin. Plain, simple, can't mean anything else. So you can't say that Mary was not a virgin when Jesus was conceived, because it's clear. And remember that when the Old Testament is quoted in the New Testament by the writers of the New Testament, they almost always choose the Septuagint version. So there's no doubt but what that this is a prediction of the virgin birth, and the son born of the virgin will be called Emmanuel, which means God with us. That does not rule out, however, another child being born as a sign to Israel in those days. Is that okay? Now, this is tricky, and you don't have to agree with me. You can run off and read commentaries, but let's go on a little bit. Now, in verse 15, to Ahaz, Isaiah says, "Curds and honey he shall eat, that he may know to refuse the evil and choose the good. Before the child shall know to refuse the evil and choose the good, the land that you dread will be forsaken by both their kings." Now that sounds like a child born in the immediate future. Is that okay? And this little child, like all little children, is going to come to an age of accountability when he knows right from wrong and he begins to choose right from wrong. Bar mitzvah time. How old is a kid when he really begins to choose right from wrong and begins to be accountable? 12. All right, so you might say, look, Ahaz, there's a little boy going to be born here in your time period, and you can watch him grow up, and it's going to be hard time. Why curds and honey? Jesus didn't grow up eating curds and honey. Why is this little kid going to grow up eating curds and honey? What are curds? That's cheese, cottage cheese. Cottage cheese, because you don't have any nursing calves and nursing goats and nursing lambs, and there's milk from the old cows, but we're in lean times economically, we're in hard times, the agricultural land is in ruin, so you raise your kids on honey and cottage cheese. So this little boy is going to grow up eating a lean and skimpy diet. But if you watch this little boy grow up, by the time he's at the age of accountability, both of these northern threats will be gone. Okay? Is that all right? Nobody want to stand up and yell heresy or anything? Send an email. Verse 17, "The Lord will bring the king of Assyria upon you and your people and your father's house, days that have not come since the day that Ephraim departed from Judah." I'm going to get the 10 northern tribes out of the way that you consider your big threat. I'm going to get Syria out of the picture. But those Assyrians that you paid all that money to, do you think that they're going to honor their treaty with you? No, they're going to come down and they're going to knock on the door of Jerusalem. So you kind of compounded your situation, O King Ahaz. All right? You don't have to worry about the immediate threat. You got 12 years here before it'll really get to be serious. And sure enough, that's what happens a little later on. What's the purpose of having a sign? That's a great... You always ask the best questions. Answer from one of our people that's read ahead. Or the Jews are big on prophecy. The whole Bible isn't written yet. Yes. Ahaz isn't going to believe it, but the people of Israel, there will be devout people in the people of Israel that will believe it. There are Jews today, and there were Jews in Jesus' time who believed Isaiah, right? So it benefits people that have a limited understanding, yes. We have the whole Bible today. We don't need so many signs and wonders and miracles. Verse 18. It shall come to pass in that day that the Lord will whistle for the fly that is in the farthest part of the rivers of Egypt, and for the bee that is in the land of Assyria. They will come, and all of them will rest in the desolate valleys and in the clefts of the rocks and on all the thorns and the pastures. Now, God's saying, I'm going to unleash a whole bunch of nasty flies, those little bitey flies that you can't get rid of, and I'm going to put some nasty, mean, wild bees, and I'm going to send them against you. I'm going to send trouble in the form of bees from Assyria and flies from Egypt to pester you Jews. Does that have an immediate prophecy solution? Yes. Is there anything in that could be long term? Yep. Same thing happened at the end of the age we live in right now, because the World War III started by will be started, according to Daniel, by an invasion from Egypt, responded to by an invasion from Syria and Russia. So exactly the same stage setting in our own day. Double, another one of these double fulfillments. Tricky. One of the clues is that little phrase, in that day, which says, got to look and see, this might have a long-term as well as a short-term fulfillment. Might be both, might not be both. Verse 20, in that same day the Lord will shave with a hired razor and with those from beyond the river, with the king of Assyria, the head and the hair and the legs, and remove the beard. There's a picture. The king of Assyria is going to come in with a razor and shave all the beards off of you Jewish men, and all the hair off your legs, and all the hair off your head. And to a Jewish man, that is utterly disgraceful, because your beard and your long hair is your masculinity, and he's going to just shave, reduce you. The men are just going to just be reduced to bald and shaved and humiliated. So that's not good. And in verse 21, it shall be in that day that a man will keep alive a young cow and two sheep, and it will be from the abundance of milk that they give that he will eat curds, for curds and honey everyone will eat who is left in the land. That ties in with the little boy growing up eating curds and honey. That shows the depletion of the livestock and so on. It shall happen in that day that wherever there could be 1,000 vines, grapevines, worth 1,000 shekels of silver, it will be briars and thorns. Saw that earlier in Isaiah? That the vineyard of the house of the Lord yielded wild grapes instead of good grapes, and so God's going to replace it with thorns and briars. And with arrows and bows, men will come there, because all the land will become briars and thorns. All of the good stuff that Uzziah did is all undone. All the nice, rich terracing and agricultural land and the wells and all the productive lands, all undone by Ahaz, the grandson of Ahaz here. To any hill which could be dug with a hoe, you will go there for fear of the briars and thorns, and it will become a range for oxen and a place for sheep to roam. So the briars and thorns are really nasty, and people would prefer living in an old cistern than trying to build a house out in the briar field. Pretty sad for a land that was previously lush and fertile. All right, chapter 8. Moreover, the Lord said to me, take a large scroll and write on it with a man's pen. It would be a strong lead pencil or a ballpoint pen or a scribe. I want you to set up a big billboard. I want you to take out a full-page ad in the Jerusalem Post, and I want you to write this word on it. And the word I want you to write on this big scroll for everybody to see, this billboard, is Meher Shalhash Shalal Hashbaz. There's another one of those nice names for your son, your second son. What does that mean? The spoil speeds, the prey hastens. Does anybody have an alternative translation? Speed the spoil, hasten the booty. On with it, on with the judgment. Would you imagine if you sent this kid to school and everybody wanted to know what his name is, and he had to tell his friends and explain what it was all about. Now, Isaiah is to take witnesses to this, faithful witnesses, Uriah the priest and Zechariah the son of Zebarakiah. Take two witnesses to the writing of this big bulletin board with this boy's name in it. And then Isaiah says, I went into the prophetess. His wife is called a prophetess. And she conceived and bore a son. And the Lord said to me, call his name Meher Shalal Hashbaz. Now, is that the son that is the immediate fulfillment of the prophecy in the previous chapter? Maybe. Could be. Not 100% positive, but sounds reasonable. For before this child shall have knowledge to cry, my father and my mother, the riches of Damascus and the spoil of Samaria, but will be taken away before the king of Assyria. Now, this is a little bit different figure of speech, because earlier we had the idea of a boy coming to the age of accountability. Now we're talking about a small boy coming to the age where he says, Mama, Dada. How old is a boy when he says, Mommy, Daddy? A year, 2 years. So by the time your son, your second son, Isaiah, is a couple of years old, by the time he's coming to Mommy and Daddy and calling after you, the threat from the north will be gone. Okay. Passage of time here now already. This could be, and I think it probably is, the immediate fulfillment of the prophecy. And if you go to commentaries, you'll get a zillion opinions on that. So I sort of like it. But it doesn't matter. There's a real second son born to Isaiah. It's a real sign to Israel. It's another sign that the threat from the north is going to shift rather quickly. And the king of Assyria is going to be the one that does it. The Lord also spoke to me again. Now here we have the Lord speaking to Isaiah in verse 6. Inasmuch as these people refuse the waters of Shiloh that flow swiftly. In Jerusalem is the pool of Siloam, fed by a gentle flowing stream. Because the people of Israel have refused the gently flowing water of my peace and my love. Shalom means peace. Because they've refused my grace, refused my gentle love, then what am I going to do? The Lord, therefore, will bring up over them the waters of the river, Euphrates River, strong and mighty. The king of Assyria and all his glory, he will go up out of all of his channels, over all of his banks. He'll pass through Judah. He'll overflow, pass over. He'll reach up to the neck, and the stretching out of his wings, change of metaphor to a big eagle, bird of prey, will fill the breadth of your land, O Emmanuel. You guys don't want the gentle healing love of God, so he's going to turn a big giant flood against you from the north by the Assyrians. And the Assyrians, in fact, come down and plunder a great deal of Judah and besiege Jerusalem. And it's just like a flood of water coming up to the neck. That's how dangerous it will be for Israel. And then right at the end, there's this little reference to, O Emmanuel, will fill the breadth of your land, O Emmanuel. That sounds like a kind of a plea, a note of sadness, a quick prayer. Whose land is this? Emmanuel, Emmanuel, have you forgotten us? You just promised that you would send a son and he would be God with us. And here we are, we're threatened with a flood that's wiping us out and birds of prey are coming on us and the water's up to our neck. And this is your land that the enemy is destroying. Where are you, O Emmanuel? See that in there? See there that cry for help in time of dire distress? We see that in the prophets. You see Habakkuk, remember. Habakkuk sees Nebuchadnezzar's armies 150 years later coming in, and he cries out in anguish that these evil armies would come in and destroy God's people. All right, Isaiah speaks in verse 9, "Be shattered, O you peoples, and be broken in pieces. Give ear, all of you from far countries, gird yourselves, but be in pieces. Be broken in pieces, gird yourselves, but be broken in pieces. Take counsel together, it will come to nothing. Speak the word, but it will not stand, for God is with us." So Isaiah says, look, you guys, don't worry about this temporary clear air turbulence. Don't worry about the events on the immediate horizon that look so dire and so terrible. God has a long-term promise to save Israel, and he will. See, that's what Isaiah says. He says, the plans of all the enemies who conspire against you will be shattered. The Palestinians and the Egyptians and the Iranians and all of the terrorists that threaten Israel at this very day again, their plans are going to come to nothing. It looks pretty dark right now, doesn't it? God is with us. There we have that. Now that right there in the end of verse 10, we have God is with us. There's the Emmanuel again. God is with us. Now Isaiah is bound to be a little discouraged in the middle of all this, and God speaks to him. The Lord spoke thus to me with a strong hand. Pretty nice to get up in the night when everything's going wrong around you and the world's falling apart and you see it's all hopeless, and God comes and comforts you and says, hang in there. You're doing fine. And here's what the Lord says to Isaiah. He says, the Lord strengthened me that I should not walk in the way of this people. Do not say a conspiracy concerning all what this people call conspiracy. Do not be afraid of their threats, nor be troubled. The Lord of hosts, him you shall hallow. Let him be your fear, and let him be your dread. Ever heard that before anywhere? Paul says that in 1 Corinthians. This is a small matter what you people think of me. I'm really not terribly concerned whether you like me or you don't like me, but I am very, very concerned what the Lord thinks of me.
It's interesting that most of the prophecy that's given is given during very, very hard and difficult times.
Of confusion. Yeah.
It's easy to get discouraged and easy to think that God really isn't in control
anymore. Absolutely right. And isn't it nice that God always has an Isaiah or a prophet who'll stand up and say, hang in there, folks, it's all going to work out. God will keep his promises. He does honor his promises, but it sure can get rough at times. And I think it's getting rough right now in our period of history. If you check the news from the Middle East, it's heating up like a pressure cooker over there right now. Okay? And there's a wonderful verse 14, a word of great comfort. He will be a sanctuary, but a stone of stumbling and a rock of offense to both the houses of Israel, as a snare and a trap to the inhabitants of Jerusalem. And many among them shall stumble, they shall fall and be broken, be snared and taken. Starts out with, the Lord is a sanctuary for his people. The Lord is a refuge. The Lord is a strong tower. The righteous man runs into it and is saved, says Proverbs. Run to the Lord in times like this, when the world's falling apart, when things are pressing on you. Run to the Lord, and he is a sanctuary, and you don't have to worry if your relationship with God is right. The danger is not against you, it's against the unbelieving masses. God's going to prune down the whole country till we get a remnant. Remember? All right, so to those who are unbelieving, it's a dangerous time because God will be a snare and a trap, and many will stumble because of him and be taken. A or B, take your choice. Follow the Lord, safe. Ignore the Lord, big trouble. Bind up the testimony. Seal the law among my disciples, and I will wait on the Lord who hides his face from the house of Jacob, and I will hope in him. Here am I and the children whom the Lord has given me. We are for signs and wonders in Israel from the Lord of hosts who dwells in Mount Zion. Now, who's speaking here? Could be Isaiah. I'm going to propose that who is speaking here is the Messiah. Let me see if I can defend that a little bit. bind up the testimony, seal the law among my disciples. I, Messiah, it could be Isaiah, it could be Messiah, I will wait on the Lord who hides his face from the house of Jacob. And I will hope in him. Would that be true of Jesus in his lifetime? Yeah, that would be true of Jesus. Finding that he came to his own and his own received him not. Would that be true? But the real clincher is the next verse 18. Verse 18 is, here am I and the children whom the Lord has given me. We are for signs and wonders in Israel from the Lord of hosts, who dwells, present tense, who is dwelling on Mount Zion. Now, that's quoted in the New Testament. That's quoted in the book of Hebrews in the New Testament, and it's quoted of Jesus. And what's it about in the New Testament? Who are these people that are signs and wonders for Israel? There's us, the Gentiles. There's another parallel verse. There's coming a time in history when Jesus will show up in the throne room of the Father in the presence of Israel, and he say, oh, by the way, I have all these friends with me. I have all these sons and daughters that I brought along with me, and we are presented before the throne of the Father as God's precious children. And Israel is in amazement. See, that's the way it turns out in Hebrews. It's kind of a victory shout of Jesus, and he says, oh, it's not just Israel I'm saving. So we'll see later on in Isaiah, God says, oh, I'm not only just going to save Israel, I'm going to throw some Gentiles in too as a sort of an extra prize.
You're in good harmony again with Scott, because he makes the same point this morning.
Excellent.
The stumbling block was that Israel saw themselves just nationally.
Yeah.
As the people of God.
Great. Excellent. Good. Good to have one spirit here. Right. Hope we have all the same spirit. This is not easy stuff. But again, this might want to have you go over and look at Hebrews. This incredible picture in Hebrews. Why did Jesus go to the cross? Because of the joy set before him. He endured the cross, despising the shame thereof, and is seated at the right hand of God. What is the joy set before Jesus? It's us. What does Jesus look forward to after the anguish of the cross? It's being with us. What will he do when he collects his church, his bride together? He'll take us up to the throne of the Father and present us to all the angels in the throne, and he'll present us to Israel. And he'll say, look, Israel, you thought this was all about you. It wasn't. It was never all about you. It's about the whole world, and here's all these other people. So was it worth it all? Yeah. So that's the idea. Here am I. That's the shout of triumph. Here am I, says Jesus, and the children whom the Lord has given me. We are for signs and wonders in Israel from the Lord of hosts, Lord of armies, who dwells in Mount Zion. That sort of suggests Jesus has never left Mount Zion. Sounds like he's the invisible ruler in Jerusalem right now at this very hour when people are fighting over Jerusalem. Okay? Pretty neat. Isaiah has layers and layers and layers of meaning to dig out. When they say to you, seek those who are mediums and wizards, who whisper and mutter, should not a people seek their God? In these times of panic, don't go off for fortune tellers, and don't go read what the secular prophets of the day are saying and the prognosticators. Just stick to the, get your nose in the Bible. Should not a people seek their God? Should they seek the dead on behalf of the living? To the law and to the testimony. Get your nose in the Bible. I found that little clipping I gave you in the yellow sheet from the San Jose Mercury. Secular article on biblical illiteracy in America. Not in the churches, but everywhere. It's in the churches too, but here is Isaiah saying, to the law and to the testimony. Go get your nose in the Bible. That's where you'll get your strength and your grounding and your solid advice. To the law and to the testimony. If they do not speak according to this word, it is because there's no light in them. Sort out and see who are the false teachers, and see if what they say is contrary to the Bible or not. Test, 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 evaluate, discern, pray, because there's lots of deception today.
Leonard, wasn't that why the signs were given to?
That would be another reason, sure. Power positive.
So
Oh, there's a zillion websites out there that are subtly off base and would rope you in and get you hooked into their deception and their cult. And the devil never comes knocking on your door with horns and a long tail and breathing fire. You'd turn him away right away, but he'll come along in the guise of a soft speaking minister in the name of God and lure you into his cult and make big bucks off of you and give you all kinds of wonderful things. And if you're biblically illiterate, then you're vulnerable to that. As never before. Never before. Okay? So all of you know need to go read through the Bible this week. So ignore these false teachers. There's no light in them. They shall pass through it hard-pressed and hungry. It shall happen when they are hungry that they will be enraged and curse their king and their God and look upward. Then they will look to the earth and see trouble and darkness, gloom and anguish, and they will be driven into darkness. So that's the fate of false teachers. When God pulls the rug out from under him, which he does with false teachers, that would be like 2 Peter and like Jude. What does God do with false teachers? He sends them into the outer darkness. Gets rid of them, judges them swiftly. That's what that's about. Nevertheless, the gloom will not be upon her who is distressed. As when he first lightly esteemed the land of Zebulun and the land of Naphtali, and afterward more heavily oppressed her, by the way of the sea beyond the Jordan, in Galilee of the Gentiles, the people who walked in darkness have seen a great light. Those who dwell in the land of the shadow of death, upon them a light has shined. Everybody heard that? You heard that before? Heard Handel's Messiah? Easter? Easter time? This is a long-term prophecy about the Messiah, who would spend most of his life up in Galilee, an insignificant part in the north, the land of Zebulun and Naphtali, up at the north end of Israel. Nothing good could come out of Nazareth. Nothing good can come out of the north. This is the part of Israel most vulnerable to Syria and Syria and Assyria, most vulnerable to be destroyed. The people that are going to be put into darkness when the Assyrians replace all the inhabitants in the land, and it's right there that God will plant the Messiah. The people who lived in great darkness have seen a great light. Beautiful picture of the Messiah who will come from Galilee. The people upon whom the shadow of death hovered will see a great light. You have multiplied the nation and increased its joy. They rejoice before you according to the joy of harvest. This is leaping way ahead now. This is one of those great parentheses that leaps to the end of the age. You have multiplied the nation and increased its joy. They rejoice before you according to the joy of harvest, as men rejoice when they divide the spoil. You've broken the yoke of his burden, the staff of his shoulder. That is, Messiah has broken the back of the Assyrian, which is exactly what happened at the second coming of Christ. And God destroys the man of sin and the northern armies. Just book of Revelation there. The rod of the oppressor. You have broken the yoke of his burden, the staff of his shoulder, the rod of his oppressor, as in the day of Gideon. As in Gideon's day, when Gideon's little army of 300 defeated a superior foe. For every warrior's sandal from the noisy battle and the garments rolled in blood will be used for burning and fuel of fire. That's kind of Armageddon. Now, get this beautiful little verse here. For unto us a child is born. Unto us, that's unto Israel, a child is born. Unto us a son is given. The government will be upon his shoulder, and his name will be called. Four names. The Latin Vulgate says six names, but the better Hebrew would be four names. His name will be called Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, Prince of Peace. Wonderful Counselor. In Hebrew, these are really good. The Wonderful Counselor is the one who comes with healing balm. The Healing Counselor. The one who listens and and helps and gives comfort and who heals. That's your wonderful counselor. That's Jesus. You can go to Jesus for comfort, for counseling, for healing, the balm of Gilead. That's Jesus. He will work things through for you. He is mighty God. This is El Gabor. And Gabor is the word for the powerful warrior. He's the great and mighty powerful warrior. The Lord of hosts, in charge of all the armies. Can Jesus be strong when he needs to be strong? Yes. Can he be gentle when he needs to be? Yes, that's what meekness is. He is the Father of eternity.
Lambert, is that part of 9:6 talking about the Trinity as well? The Holy Spirit, the Wonderful Counselor, you're talking about the Eternal Father and the Trinity.
Well, these names are all applied to the Messiah right here. So the Messiah. Yeah, this is... Because this is about the Son. A Son will be given, and the names attached to the Son. When Jesus comes on his white horse in Revelation 19, he has many names. He comes as the representative of the whole Trinity. So that's what that means. He's the Father of eternity, the everlasting Father. That means he's unchanging. That means he's outside of time. It means that he's always your loving, caring Father. You always go to him. He never changes. That's what that's about. Then he is the Prince of Peace. Remember that the word peace, shalom, means the peace that comes from being a whole person. He's the one that brings peace and wholeness. So those are the four titles of the Son, and as I mentioned, the Latin Vulgate makes that into six names. Well, you can obviously do that if you want. Upon the throne of David and over his kingdom, to order it and establish it with judgment and justice from that time forward, even forever, the zeal of the Lord of hosts will perform this. This Son will grow up and sit on a throne in a place. Where is the throne of David located? Is it in Zion, Illinois? No. Jerusalem. Is this a symbolic throne? No. It's a literal throne, isn't it? Over what kingdom will he be the main king over Israel? What is he going to do? He's going to establish order, justice from this time forward, and it's backed up by the zeal of the Lord of hosts, the God who does what he says he's going to do. Promises what he's said that he would do. Long-term picture. All right? That's a good place to stop, I think. No big questions on this? Hard stuff here. Steve, would you pray?
Lord, thank you that you are faithful to your promises. And most of all, that you are faithful to the promise to do what we could not do for ourselves, what Israel could not do, that you took upon yourself the sins of the world in this child.